Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Word in Your Ear. There is an episode of Hancock's Half Hour, which is called The Missing Page. And it starts with the lad himself going to the East Cheam Library and going to the librarian and asking for the complete history of the Holy Byzantine Empire, Plato's Republic, the Iliad, and then Ulbricht's Roman Law. And the librarian is very approving. He says, these are the best books we have in the library. I'm so grateful you've asked for them. And then Hancock takes them, puts them on the ground, and then stands on them in order to reach to the top shelf, which is where the thriller that he's after is actually found. And the book is called, the book he's trying to get is called Lady Don't Fall Backwards. But now if any kind of offspring of the lad himself were attending the East Cheam Library once they've taken delivery of Johnny Rogan's new books, it would be obvious what you'd ask for in order to get the maximum elevation on the shelves. Because I've never seen books about rock bands as big as these. And it brick-like. I had to ask Johnny how he'd managed to get them here this evening with benefit of a low loader, I think.
Forklift truck.
They're extraordinary pieces of work, and so we're welcoming two people to talk about them. Obviously, the author. Would you please welcome Johnny Rogan? And then also to supply, I suppose, a bit of a kind of American context and also a kind of musician's view, friend of the podcast and previous guest on this very stage, Sid Griffin. Sid has come as Dennis Wilson this evening. Calm down, ladies.
He's wearing legs.
He's married. Sorry, girls.
Form an orderly queue.
Anyway, let's to start here. Tell us, Johnny, how the birds first entered your life. Can you remember when this was? What were the circs?
It was the 10th of June, 1965.
Oh, God.
Get used to this level of detail, by the way.
It was at 12:30 as well, I can tell you the time. It was on the light programme. I'd come home and... I'd come home to have my customary cup of coffee with two chocolate biscuits, which I normally had as my lunch... in 1960, summer of 65, I'd seen the birds in Billboard. I wasn't the most literate person at the time, thinking back. I'd just failed the 11 plus, as I recall. And I saw this, I was always on the lookout. I always read the Billboard chart, which I'm sure you did too. And it was a great predictor of the future. Because things that happened in Billboard sometimes would translate back to the UK. Some didn't, like Gary Lewis and the Playboys, forget all that. Mm-hmm. But occasionally you would hear something extraordinary, and I was always on the lookout for it. And there was a song called Mr. Tambourine Man. I don't think I even knew what a tambourine was, and I remember looking at this, what does this mean? You know, it's not a tangerine, what the hell is it? And the group's name fascinated me. I thought it was, is that Byrids? How do you pronounce this? That's as innocent as the world was. But they played it on the light programme at this lunchtime. It was an extraordinary thing hearing it for the first time. I mean, you know, the opening chords are just, you know, mind-blowing anyway. And, that's where it all started. It literally started then at the beginning from probably what was the first play on, you know, more or less the first play. I think... probably had been played on Caroline a couple of times or something.
And there's a lovely moment where you go and see it in the Albert Hall in 1968 and you wore a suit because you thought you had to wear a suit to go to the Albert Hall.
I did. I remember that very well.
There were standards in those, I'd appreciate it.
I'd been to Mass. I went to 5:30 Mass.
Oh, come on. Very good.
And got the 52 bus. And, yes, I remember it well. And, you know, what a lineup it was. Joe Cocker was there, The Move. You know, it was a fantastic lineup.
Was that a pop prom?
It wasn't called that. It was for what were called disabled kids, I think, at the time. It was a sort of charity do, and the Birds had flown over specially to headline it. The Move topped the bill for the first half. No, the Birds topped the bill for the first half and the Move for the second half. It's strangely structured. And throughout the second half, I was thrilled because people were shouting out, "Bring back the Birds." And of course, you have to remember in the context of the whole thing, is that in 68, the Birds weren't revered in the way they are now.
Right.
I'd heard they'd had a terrible live show because all you read about them was... I mean, don't forget, none of this... You never saw them live or never saw concerts back then. So you were totally reliant on things like America Calling in NME. And all I'd heard was the Birds' terrible live. And this reputation was there. And I thought, are they going to really mess it up? And they're going to the Royal Albert Hall. This is going to be a disaster. And of course it wasn't. They played great. And they probably did play great in America as well. But,
so yeah. 1965 is when they first entered your life. Sid, what about you?
Like a lot of people my age, I'm 62 in September, so I'm retiring. So that was supposed to be a joke. Sorry. You see, I don't have a job, so I should have set the joke up better. Like a lot of people my age, I couldn't afford just any old album or any old single. So you had to have a reason to purchase it besides you liked it or you knew what it was. So I waited for greatest hits packages. So I would have never bought a Gary Lewis and the Playboys single, but I would have bought Gary Lewis and the Playboys best of or something like that. So I bought Bird's greatest hits and liked it. But interestingly enough, didn't buy another album until Untitled came out, and I liked that a lot. And perhaps because we're in Kentucky, we didn't have a ton of dough. What really happened for me, even though I knew who they were as a kid, by 75, David, I didn't like the current pop music scene at all. I felt very alienated, so I was looking for something else. I bought Charlie Parker Records. I bought this, I bought that, and I bought Turn, 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 the album. Now, for those...
In 1975.
75, 10 years after the fact. And I already had two Birds albums, you recall. But the point is this. You were told throughout the late 60s and early 70s that 1960s albums, particularly pre-Sgt. Pepper, were the hit single and filler. Now, other than maybe the Beatles, that was pretty much true for so many acts. So I didn't buy it. I didn't buy anybody's album. It wasn't a greatest hits record because I didn't have a lot of money. And I bought Turn, Turn, Turn. And though I realized it was flawed and not perfect, I thought it was a brilliant album. So 10 years after Johnny, I finally got on the Birds train and have remained there ever since.
So briefly explain, Johnny, these two books, Volume 1 and Volume 2, what are they?
Well, they're books on the Birds.
No, okay.
But to be fair, you already wrote a fantastic book, Timeless Flight, originally.
And this is
nothing to do with this. This is a whole new venture, isn't it?
But I wrote that in the late 70s.
Right.
And these were... I've just been doing these for decades. I mean, they're not necessarily linear either. It's a strange thing because people say, oh, you know, when's Volume 2 coming out? They don't realise I wrote the Kevin Kelly chapter in that in 2007, which is before the first volume came out. But I'm very good at hoarding things and completing chapters and leaving them in boxes.
So the first volume is the story of the Birds.
Yes, it is, yes.
And the second volume...
is the story of the dead Birds.
There you go. Couldn't have put it better myself.
And it also...
My favourite.
There's nothing that is repeated from volume to volume. There's no repetition. In other words, the first volume is a group story. The second volume, to take, for example, Gene Clark or Gram Parsons, I don't deal with Gene's time in the Birds. Well, obviously, one has to in a page and a half, just to remind you, and similarly with Gram stuff, but really it's about what he did before, what he did after, and how all that complemented what he did in the Birds story itself, but the main thrust of it would be in volume one for the group story, and the second volume is a psychological study of all of them, I suppose.
It is extraordinary. Yeah. We'll come to that in time.
We've got a little thing on the three main characters here. This is Roger McGuinn, or Jim McGuinn, as he was then, in the... Is it the Chad Mitchell Trio?
Well, he was actually called Skinny McGuinney back then.
Playing the banjo.
So tell us about him. What are his qualities? What made him a kind of key member of the Byrds?
Well, I mean, he was the, you know, self-styled leader of the Byrds, and in musicians' union's terms, he was the leader of the Byrds. And today, if you talk to Crosby or Hillman, they'll say, yes, he was the heart and soul of the Byrds, and he was always the leader. And that's something I think, you know, that they've learned to agree with. But he emerged from the folk tradition. You can see he was a great banjo player. We think of him as the great Rickenbacker player, but it wasn't just about the guitar. He was a great Rickenbacker player. He came from Chicago originally and basically worked his way up. He was even in the Brill Building at one point, writing songs, not very successfully. And then he joined the Chad Mitchell Trio and eventually found his way to LA, and in 64 with Gene and Crosby formed a little trio called the Jet Set, and they then decided they'd be a fully fledged rock group by getting Michael Clark in and then Chris Hillman finally.
So did he always have that distinctive singing style, distinctive voice on?
Yes, I'd say he did. Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, it comes very much through the folk tradition, you know. Even today, I mean, he's got the folk den, which, you know, he tries to sing like an Irishman. It's not, you know, a lot of people find it not... He doesn't necessarily do it very successfully, but in terms of where he came from in the States, they do sound, you know... He was quite competent, very good.
And Crosby's from an incredibly kind of well-heeled background, isn't he? And
it was Crosby.
Baxter's Balladeers, is that the name of the group?
Yes.
And he was, you know, expelled from school, I think. And
Well, no, he's a Santa Barbara boy, and he comes from the Van Cortlandt family, who are really very, very wealthy, as you rightly say. His father was a cinematographer, and his mother was a blue blood. They definitely, you know, very, very wealthy background. And that's carried him through in many ways. I mean, his personality was defined by that. He did go to private schools, and he was always a rebel.
He was arrested for housebreaking, I think, at one point.
Well, they're just kid stuff, really. Yeah. I mean, he didn't need the money. So. But he's very fresh-faced there. Eddie Tickler called them Les Baxter's little dears, as I always enduringly recall. And Crosby's very embarrassed about all this. This is commercial folk. And Crosby, being the great idealist, would prefer that this stuff never existed. He's very embarrassed about that he ever had to do this. He would have preferred to have been like Travis Edmondson or a starving folky. And he did a bit of that as well. But in order to make money, he did this too. As you'll find with a lot of rock stars, it's not so much hypocrisy, but they're forced to take on different roles. They cannot play the artist 100% of the time, and there's a good example.
Sid, give us a bit of American perspective on this, you know, that Crosby's kind of background, you know, family pretty much came over on the Mayflower, didn't they, or something?
Yeah, they're Dutch, and there's a Dutch-American society that I can't remember the name of, like Daughters of the Revolution and Daughters of the Confederacy. And I think, as I recall, his mother was a member of it. And I think the guy on Doghouse Bass, isn't that his brother Ethan? His late brother Ethan? Yeah,
otherwise known as Chip.
Yeah, otherwise known as Chip there on the Doghouse Bass.
Committed suicide.
Committed suicide, tragically enough. And in the States in the early 1960s, what we now call the Great Folk Scare, there was the two strands. And the two strands are, and if you meet anybody like Michael Oakes, who's Phil's younger brother, or any of that crowd, Judy Collins or even McGuinn, I guess, they'll tell you there are two strands. And one is the people that were like John Cohen of the New Lost City Ramblers, that wanted authenticity and to be the real thing and to go sit on the porch in Appalachia and really learn how it was done. And then the other people that wanted to make some money out of it. So when the new Christy Minstrels, and by the way, the Christy Minstrels were a folk act of around the American Civil War and after the American Civil War that went on and on and on, like the Drifters or the Coasters. No original members. They went on for like 40 years. So when the folk boom came back, let's have the new Christy Minstrels. And yes, it refers to minstrel show music. And a guy named Randy Sparks and a number of other people would put together these bands, commercial folk music bands. Chris Hillman was in one called, what was it called, the Green Bar, the Back Porch?
Yeah.
Green Bar Boys and the Back Porch Majority or something like that. There are a lot of these bands in America, and this, the reason Crosby's embarrassed about this, and is because the coat and tie denotes that they're in the commercial side of things, where they do songs. Oh, the great movie A Mighty Wind,
Christopher Guest.
What he doesn't realize, of course, it became hip when lounge came in, and that's beyond his imagination. He doesn't understand what lounge is. These albums actually started selling.
But if you see A Mighty Wind, that's sort of what they were doing for real, not as a parody, not as a joke. That's what they were doing for real.
Right, so that's David Crosby.
In fact, this group, the New Christian Minstrels, is a classic example of that.
And Gene was in them for two albums.
Yeah.
So Gene Clark, tell us about Gene Clark.
Well, he's a Kansas boy, and he started off there, and he was always a songwriter from very early on. And basically, it's one of those Hollywood moments. The New Christian Minstrels are coming through town. They, without going into the full details, there was a problem. They needed another singer urgently. And he was playing in a local group, and they said, take him. And, you know, within a month, he's signed to CBS, going to Hawaii. And, you know, he's come straight from that community. From nothing, and he's suddenly in one of the biggest aggregations in the world. And a year after that, he's in the Byrds. And I don't think they'd hardly seen him in Kansas since he left. They didn't even know he was in the Byrds. I mean, a year later, he left the Christies pretty promptly. He couldn't handle the flying. He couldn't handle the... It was very intense being in the Christie Mysteries. You've got a lot of great singers in there. You know, Barry Maguire's in there, who's... And these people are full-on entertainers, and... Gene was always neurotic as well. You know, he was naturally a singer-songwriter. He wasn't a commercial performer. And to be in the Christies, you have to be top of your game every single night. And these guys were. They were seasoned entertainers. And Gene had a problem in there. He couldn't be number one in a group like that. There was five or six or seven contenders. And as Sid mentioned, Randy Sparks, who ran it like a military operation. Yeah. It was an incredibly... Yeah. Competitive thing, and he was really big on competition. Sparks, he liked that idea that you send them out there. It was like a football game, you win. And Gene was never quite comfortable in that environment, but and so he went to LA, met McGuinn, Crosby, and there's the Byrds.
So there's the Byrds, and those are, in classic fashion, that's the front line, isn't it?
Yeah.
Crosby, McGuinn,
yes,
and Clark.
Yes, they've done that photograph very well without realising that,
And everybody knows their place, rhythm section goes to the back there. Go on, Sid.
I have an interesting insight into this photograph. Maybe Johnny knows it, but I bet most of you don't. There's a wonderful woman who just retired from Oxford University's library. She was part of the researchers there, and named Toby Marks. Toby, are you here by any chance? Toby Marks is from Chicago, and she worked in a sandal shop. Now, the sandal shops of America, where you got leather goods and things made, were ground zero for hippies in 61, 62, 63, before they knew they were hippies. So on the very, very, very first Byrds tour of America, the Byrds came in, Crosby came in to the leatherware store and said he wanted we heard you all could make shirts made of leather. And they said, yes, we can make a shirt made of leather. It'll be hot as hell, but we can do that. We've done it before. So Toby Marks of Chicago, Illinois, who now lives 45 miles away from here in the Oxford area, and her friends started to make David Crosby a leather shirt. And she told me at Bluegrass School, which there is one in this country, she told me sitting next to me, by the time they'd come around on the second tour, David had put on a bit of a belly. So that's why it's a cape. The person that made it told me it was originally a shirt. Thank you.
Very
superb.
Good.
Superb.
Very good.
Which became his signature, of course, didn't it?
Yes, his signature garment. And it's been stolen. I asked him about this, and he demurred on, was it a shirt part? But he says, sad to say, I did have it for years and years and years, and someone broke into my house once and stole some items, and that was one of them.
Well, he actually had two. He had a leather cape, and that's a green suede cape. which
was, these things are important. So, yeah.
No, but seriously. No,
visually, all this is very important.
It's really important.
That's the iconic look that they had in the summer of 65. That is Carnaby Street for a start, which in itself is significant that they chose that as a fashion street.
Yes, talk about this whole.
Well, it's thing. Carnaby Street in August 65, and there's Crosby with the green suede cape. You notice those white polo necks, they were purchased in Carnaby Street. White polo necks were popular at the time. Michael Clarke loved them. McGuinn got one as well. McGuinn got a tweed suit, which he's not wearing there, but he also bought that. They had this incredibly English look when they went back. God knows what they thought of them when they went back to LA, because they were all dressed in this odd fusion
of
British hipness and tweed, which it looks quite uncool. But of course, McGuinn's already got the signature granny glasses, which I believe it was John Sebastian that inspired them. John Sebastian told him he had these cobalt glasses and said, if you stare at night into the lamps in New York and shake your head, you can get a bit high. And he said, I'll buy them.
We made our own entertainment.
And he replaced them with he got his optician, because McGuinn short-sighted. It also meant that he looked like Clark Kent. If you see early photographs of him in the jet set, he looked like Clark Kent. But he would never wear glasses. He was always stumbling into things. And there's the look. You've got Michael Clarke, the dead ringer of Brian Jones, of course, and Hillman just not quite trying to be sort of similar but not quite doing it, and Gene, you know, again, the Beatle influence is strong.
So talk to us a little bit about, you know, their first record is Mr. Tambourine Man, isn't it? Very much it's number one all over the world.
Indeed, yes.
They didn't want to do it, is that fair to say?
No, they their manager Jim Dixon came up with the idea. He was familiar with Dylan. He was the one. Well, he famously said to me, I was betting the house on Tambourine Man. But Tambourine Man was more important to me than the Birds at that point. And that's, I think, pretty significant. Crosby particularly didn't like it. Crosby didn't like Dylan. And then he became the greatest expert on Dylan in the world, you know, according to people around him. But it's that's not true either. But there's an element of truth in that. But it really... McGuinn knew Dylan from New York and actually said, you know, I always felt a bit competitive towards Dylan, which pretty presumptuous, I suggested. But no, they didn't at first. And but it was pushed. And I think when McGuinn worked out that solo and how they could compress the song and make it into, you know, take it away from the folk into a rock and roll rhythm, it worked. And I think as soon as it came into fruition, and even Michael's drums, which people don't really speak about, he had, if you listen to Pre-Flight, it's incredibly a military-style drum. And it's like somebody that's been in the military band at the age of 12 or something, and that's all he can do. But even when Hal Blaine, who played on the session, he actually incorporated some of that Michael military-style drumming. And that, you know, that's part of the magic of the song too. You could actually do a whole thesis on the construction of Mr. Tambourine Man and how it came into being. But yes, it was.
But I think you could also do a book on the look of the Birds, because
absolutely, yes.
You know, I can remember I was 15 when this arrived, and the thing about the Birds was they didn't just sound great; they looked fantastic. You couldn't get over looking at them, and McGuinn's glasses were really important to him on television. Because he got these close-ups where he looked over them.
No, he looked like a professor.
He did. He looked charismatic with the glasses in a way that he didn't.
He looked like an absent-minded professor, because it was like this staring at you almost defiantly.
Kind of Dickensian figure.
Really. Yeah, excuse my black eye, that's another story. But
That is another story, But they've still said had a very influential look, haven't they, throughout... Yeah.
Well, there's no question. They had a very influential look, I'd say, up until one of the first bands to wear cowboy hats when they did Sweetheart. And they If you ever want to get Chris Hillman to laugh, says the insider, refer to the Clarence White era as the Hippie Birds because of the extreme long hair and the beards. They're the archetypal hippie-looking band, more than the Dead. Because if you look at Lesh and the guys in the Dead, they're not really growing the hair up to the shoulder length, the unkempt beards, you know. And the Clarence White Birds with Skip Batten and all, that really did. So they were... just looking at them. In fact, that's one reason I bought Turn, Turn, Turn. It looked like a cool cover. And looking back to Griffith Park, where there's the two paths meet in Griffith Park, which is a big public park in Los Angeles near where I used to live. I stood there, and the fish I shot that I think Barry Feinstein did, their album covers looked great. They looked great on the album covers. Their album covers looked great. And I got to say, in the 1960s battle to see who had the best bowl haircut, you've got three brilliant Prince Valiants right there.
Yeah. That's true.
With George Harrison in Help, look at George Harrison's hair in Help. It is unbelievable. But other than him or Brian Jones, you've got three winners right there.
You say, how many groups in about 1991?
There you are. Like
that? Here's another group looking funny. Yeah. Sid on the left there.
I can give you a cheap laugh right now. Ready?
Yeah, go on.
I had flu of about 103, and I vomited about 10 minutes later.
Oh, very good.
It was about 112 in the desert when we found that place, and I was really, really ill, and I begged them not to do the photo shoot, but that's Stampede by the Springfield, which, of course, is a band that bizarrely, maybe Johnny can shed some light on this. This is our imitation of an unreleased Buffalo Springfield album cover. They shot the cover. The album never came out. Bizarrely, Stampede, this album cover we're imitating, was given out by Scholastic Books for the school year of 67, 68, or 66, 67, because they'd already printed the cover, and they gave these out at schools in America, and you were supposed to take it and put it as a protective cover on something you wanted at home. So even I, as a kid, had the cover of Stampede, of an album that never came out by a band I'd barely heard of.
Yeah, it was legendary. Well, he shut up the cowboy hat.
Yeah, we're trying to do the whole thing. But what I was going to ask Johnny is, do you all know the story that Hillman was unsure of the Birds for a long time, and he actually took McGuinn to the Whiskey in April 66 to see the Buffalo Springfield and say, Roger, maybe we should manage bands. What do you think about these guys?
Hillman specifically was asked to manage them, which was an extraordinary thing because Hillman had never managed anything in his life. And the idea that a member of the Birds would manage another band was extraordinary. And Hillman, to give him his due, said, well, no. And they ended up with a pair called Charlie Green and Brian Stone, who managed Sonny Cher. And
I want to talk about their relationships with a couple of key artists. They were, is it fair to say they were obsessed with the Beatles?
Early on, certainly.
And they saw them on Ed Sullivan
probably,
and
then
A Hard Day's Night? Wasn't A Hard Day's Night
the whole early image of the Birds before they found the Greensuede cape and the leather cape and the granny glasses. They actually had suits.
Skinny ties.
Black suits, rather like this. And they got rid of them. It was part of the original contract, but they had to get the suit. Before they signed to CBS, there's a woman who's very important in all this called Naomi Hirshhorn, who is an off-Broadway producer, and she put the money up for the Birds. She gave them $5,000, which is a hell of a lot of money then for to have an interest in an idea, basically, that wasn't signed to anybody. And part of that money went on the suits, and then they systematically... The suits were stolen, and Michael gave his away to Little Richard's drummer. I mean, the Birds are very blasé. They move very quickly, and the suits became passé to them. But that was the Beatle image, and they moved away from the Beatles pretty quickly. I mean, by the time they did the first album, they were more into Dylan than they were into the Beatles, and the Beatles thing had gone. When I say the Beatles, I mean the Merseybeat Beatles.
Right, yeah.
But they always followed the Beatles, and there was always this parallel thing going on. They met the Beatles in August 65. There was a hell of a lot of, I've seen letters from George Harrison to Derek Taylor saying, tell McGuinn that we're doing a song called If I Needed Someone, and I've taken it from the Bells of Rimini and She Don't Care About Time, kind of fused the two of them and stuff like this.
Well, McGuinn was always saying he was looking for a sound that was somewhere between the Beatles and Bob Dylan.
Oh, he did, yeah. That was his dream of what the Birds were at that particular time.
Is it the case that for kind of folkies like they'd been before the Byrds, seeing and hearing Hard Day's Night kind of changed what they thought they could do in terms of a band, what they could do with acoustic guitars and stuff?
It changed it for everybody in America at that time. I mean, you know, the Beatles changed everything. I mean, Crosby talks about how he went in to see that film and then he came out and he actually was twirling around lampposts, you know, which, if you think of the size of Crosby now, it's amazing to think yeah. that he would be athletic enough to do
bending
that. But that's how high they were getting from just seeing the Beatles on stage, as everybody in America in 64 was, of course. I mean, Gene Clark famously, when he, you know, he talks about hearing them on a jukebox and thinking, you know, it's a Road to Damascus thing and I'm off to LA.
Yeah.
You know, same old story. But that photograph is amazing because it's from Sgt. Pepper's, as you can
see. That was a Day in the Life recording, I think, wasn't it?
Excuse me?
Was it a Day in the Life they're recording that day, I think?
I'm not sure. I reckon it might be Lovely Rita, yeah. but it could be. Crosby had, yes, he'd... Crosby was played a Day in the Life. One has to be very careful about what day is in Beatleology. But I love the fact that he's effectively, you know, there's three Beatles and, oh, Crosby. Is that David Crosby? No, that isn't Ringo, is it? No, there he is. And he's, I always thought he'd... I deliberately put that in that book because I don't think anybody had really seen that photograph. I found it. And years ago, and I thought it was great the fact that there were three Beatles and Crosby in the same photograph. And
That was their relationship with the Beatles.
Yeah.
But the other key one is obviously with Bob Dylan.
Well, that is a very, very significant. That's really early. That's they'd recorded Mr. Tambourine Man. It hadn't even come out at that stage. And look how cool they look. You know, look at Michael at the back with the stripes. Crosby's got some strange-looking Angora thing. And as Burguin said to me, Dylan is there and he's going like this, as in, I don't know if I'm crazy being here, but look, I'm here. And it was at a Japanese restaurant. I've never been able to find out where the actual venue was, to tell you the truth. But it was...
Well, he saw him at Ciro's, which is now the Comedy Store.
Yeah, that isn't Ciro's, though. That was at a restaurant.
Ciro's has no steps.
Yeah, well, they are. And he...
But he was incredibly supportive of them, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't.
There's a lovely story in the book where he goes to the CBS party, but he refuses to go to the CBS party unless he can take the Byrds with him and introduce them.
Yeah, he said they try to get in and they say you're not invited, and a bit like this gig tonight. And he said, well, you know, if they're not coming in, I'm not coming in. And that had a massive effect. I mean, his influence at CBS, being Dylan, changed everything for everybody, just as Doris Day's influence at Dylan, at CBS as well. The fact that the Byrds are produced by Terry Melcher, who was Doris Day's son, coupled with the fact that Dylan was actively in their corner, were very important factors.
Yeah. Would you say that that was also important to Bob Dylan, not just fact that they sold a lot of records or whatever, in kind of moving him away from...
He knew absolutely how important, as you would.
Well, I think when he heard The Animal's House, The Rising Sun, and Tambourine Man, and so on, and Manfred Mann's probably early things, clearly. But it was interesting. It's Bob Newworth. It's the guy that told Bob Dylan, "You've got to get on the bandwagon with these guys, the Byrds. Listen to this stuff. This is fantastic. This is your music." And Newworth swears that the first few times he played Dylan certain songs, and I think Sonny and Cher are part of this list, that Dylan didn't recognize his own tunes. But there is something I want to interject here that Johnny probably knows, but you all won't. Now, when I lived in L.A. For 14 happy years, all these old musician guys that were in the various bands of the time, be they the famous bands or bands like the Sons of Adam, who were great and never went anywhere, they all... When it came time to the Byrds, they got real serious and said respectful things. Whether or not the Byrds were good live or whatever, they always said respectful things. And I asked several of them, and including a guy named Denny Bruce, not Lenny Bruce, Denny Bruce. He's a manager and a scenester. He was Neil Young's, he'd hate me being qualifying by this way, he was Neil Young's roommate during the Springfield era. And Denny and all these guys would tell me, the reason the Byrds were so revered by the Southern California musicians of the day is, look at these guys. They had uniforms early on that Little Richard's band stole, so they didn't have to wear uniforms. Until the Byrds, the entire Sunset Strip were bands playing covers, and they were almost the same set, you know, a Papa Umau Mau and New Orleans covers like Gary Lewis Bond's New Orleans, Wait On Your New Orleans, and they'd end the show with What'd I Say? The entire strip was dead. Choreography, matching suits, grease in the hair, the whole thing. And all those old guys revered the Byrds because they blew that out of the water. Now you could play original songs, you could dress like you wanted to dress, you could have long hair, you could do what you wanted to do. That didn't exist in 60, 61, 62, 63, 64 in the strip. Did not exist. And their success at Ciro's blew it out of the water. Yep. It never went back to being covers.
Now, let's talk about the folk rock sound, which they obviously partly pioneered. And, you know, this became the sound of 65, 66, didn't it?
Well, yeah, to the extent you've got the Sound of Silence there, which is a manufactured folk rock song. You know, it was an acoustic song, and they put electrical instrumentation on it.
Directly influenced by hearing Mr. Tambourine Man.
Yeah, simply because of the Byrds. CBS basically doubled their money. And the Sound of Silence was far more successful over here by the Bachelors, of course, than it was by Simon and Garfunkel. But seriously, you know, that was number one in the States. And you know, I mean, you know all the stories about how Paul Simon, he didn't even realise that it happened.
No,
it transformed everything. But it was really the end of the genesis of folk rock, if you will. I mean, we had, you know, Barry Maguire's was top of the charts with Eva Destruction. We had the Turtles with an Ain't Me Babe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Sonny and Cher, which was a similar.
And Sonny and Cher, yeah, who stole the Byrds act. They went to Ciro's and taped it.
Yeah.
They taped That's How They Did All I Really Want to Do and got it and tried to get it out before the Byrds version, which, you know, got a bit of sabotage going on there. It's remarkable when you think back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but they were old music business hands, weren't they? These people, they were not green, were they?
No. Well, but it was still pretty young. Sonny Bono was pushing 30, but, you know, Cher certainly wasn't.
Right. Yeah. So folk rock was the sound of the day. So this is a picture taken to Trafalgar Square later in that.
You can
in
just
that.
Imagine this being done for a Melody Maker photographer, actually, because, you know, with a kind of Heed the Byrds or
it's probably,
you know, Byrds Take Flight.
Do you know what I found when I was looking? Do you know what they were on? They were on the cover of Fabulous magazine in 1965 in glorious colour. It was kind of, you know, which is your favourite bird, girls? You know, it was not the cool hip thing at all. You know, so now this tour
was a disastrous tour
of England. Didn't go brilliantly. Is that fair to say? Because they shocked everybody by tuning, didn't they?
They tuned up.
Well, nobody had ever seen or heard a group tune before.
No, they hadn't. You could talk about this forever, but the point is that's Trafalgar Square in what was the wettest summer in years, and and they stuck them in Trafalgar Square surrounded by filthy pigeons, which is what you did to touring groups, particularly Americans at the time. But nevertheless, I think a missing factor in all of this is that when they came over to tour, they'd been touring the States with a whole contingent of people. They had dancers. They had a troupe. They were followed by what was the burgeoning hippie movement before the word had even been invented. They had 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old girls following across the States. They had somebody called Carl Franzoni, who was 32 years old at the time and had curly hair, was the king of the hipsters. They actually had a movement going in the States, but they came over here, just the five of them, without their own instruments, without their own amplification equipment. They had to borrow, you know, material, the instruments and stuff to play. It was badly organized. They were playing sometimes four or five sets a night. You know, they were playing in places like the Ram Jam Club in Brixton, having played somewhere else in R&B clubs. You know, where Georgie Fame would be playing. I mean, it was a what they called a torture tour, and they'd just done a major coast-to-coast tour in the States. So and of course, the British, if Keith Ortham had been here tonight, he actually interviewed them at the time, and he was very anti the Byrds in the press. They certainly made enemies here without even realizing you could make enemies, because they were terribly outspoken. They didn't do what pop stars were supposed to do. You know, Crosby could say anything to you.
Is that why the press didn't like them? Because the press were incredibly aggressive, weren't they? The English press.
Well, they were. I think the tour had been advertised as... They'd been advertised as the wonderful Mervyn Conn as America's answer to the Beatles, which wasn't even original to him. But calling anybody an answer to the Beatles and then sending them to the UK in 65 was not a clever thing to do. And the irony was the Beatles came to see them and loved them, and they had a great relationship with the Beatles. And actually, a month later, they're in Benedict Park sharing acid with, you know, in a shower with, you know, with Lennon and Harrison, who actually attended the recording sessions for Turn, Turn, Turn. But you're moving on swiftly.
No, you mentioned acid, and that takes us to the next part of the story, really, which is how they make this transition from folk rockers to psychedelia.
Well, the Byrds were always moving forward, and when they returned to America, they went on another coast-to-coast tour, and I didn't believe it for a while, because McGuinn, somebody had told me that they bought a cassette recorder in the summer of 65, and cassette recorders didn't exist in the summer of 65, but apparently they did. I mean, somehow, McGuinn got an early cassette recorder from Philips in an experimental stage. It's only a little thing, as we know, but they taped Coltrane and Ravi Shankar and on each side, and they just played this constantly until it was part of their, you know, their psychic bloodstream or whatever. And they began, you know, McGuinn began playing guitar like a saxophone, and we had Raga Rock sitar-like breaks when he was doing the B-side, which is why. And this was all terribly innovative, and it got, you know, their manager Jim Dixon suddenly got terribly thought this is incredibly significant, that the Byrds weren't just about Turn, 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 which he didn't like. He wanted them to do something even greater than that, and the ingredients are there. You know, Crosby had seen Coltrane. I mean, you must remember these were great in their way, great musicians and great tastemakers. Crosby was a tastemaker. He always liked to be surrounded by hip people, and he was there from the set. And so was McGuinn. You know, he knew his stuff.
And he around this time met a guru who persuaded him to change his name, because he was Jim McGuinn, wasn't he?
So why
did he change his name to Roger? I mean, it seems so extraordinary. If you're going to change your name.
He became involved with this religious organisation called Subud, which was basically, it was an Indonesian religion, for want of a better word. I know if you call it a religion. Yes, it was a religion. And was pretty popular in America at the time, as various fringe-like things were. And he became part of that, and it was a very positive thing. And McGuinn's got this positive thing about him. He was into Norman Vincent Peale as well. I mean, you know, McGuinn comes from originally a Roman Catholic background, but he went through a lot of different religions. But it was all about his motto. Whenever he was interviewed at that time, he would always begin or end the interview with, "And I trust everything will turn out all right." And that was very important. He actually did a song called that years later as well. But the point was positivism. And that's what Crosby liked about him. Crosby liked the fact that McGuinn could be positive. He's the most remote and aloof character you'll ever meet, McGuinn, if you've met him, and I'm sure you have. But yet, there's a positivism about him which is extraordinary. And Crosby, that's how that relationship all worked, and it worked very well for a time. And so the religious part of it was profound. The change of name didn't actually come about until as late as 67. A lot of those people in Subud changed their name. You know, there was, who was he? The Bob.
Shepherd.
There's more than him. The guy did Sounds of Goodbye and the duo.
Oh, right.
That'll have to go into the religious history of the
Hamilton
Byrds.
Camp.
Yeah, Hamilton Camp was Bob Camp, and he changed it to Hamilton, which sounds pretty cool, I suppose. But with McGuinn, his wife Dolores changed her name to Ianthe, which I-N-T-H-E, which is that's pretty exotic.
Not
Xanthe, but Ianthe. Yeah.
And they had to send a wave to Indonesia for permission, didn't they?
And they said the vibration of your voice is an R, so they said send 10 names that begin with R, and he
they'll pick one.
He and the Indonesian guy had to choose one, and he said he put a load of nonsense down, like Rocket.
Rocket McGuinn, didn't he?
I still don't believe that. I mean, I'd like to see the list. See what he really.
But it's all part of their mythology.
Yeah, retro was one, and there we go.
So they're you know, very influenced by Indian music, as were the Beatles at the same time. Are you starting to see tension in the group at this time?
No, well, this is the key. Well, you not only see tension, this is the most, probably the, one of the most important stages of the entire history of the birds. This is circa February, March 1966. You notice there's only four people at that table. And on the 22nd of February, Gene Clark failed to get on a flight to New York. And this is a New York press conference. And that's the press conference for 8 Miles High. That's where they. That's why McGuinn is playing that. He can't play it, by the way.
He can't play.
No, there is no sitar on why. It's McGuinn's Rickenbacker playing through this instrument in a cigar box with amplification to make it sound like a sitar.
Clark and Hillman look mightily impressed, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They really do. Yeah.
Absolutely thrilled.
But it was. But isn't it amazing? They had a press conference for 8 Miles High. I mean, not the most commercial song, but they actually had a full press conference. Conducted by Derek Taylor, who's already hyped it up and saying 8 Miles High will be, you know, could be their it should be their third number one, and if it's not, they may be overtaken by the Mamas and Papas. And he's already, you know, talk about putting pressure on you before you've even begun. But they actually have a press conference. They really think that single's important. See, this is when singles were important. This is like the Beatles having a press conference of Strawberry Fields Forever. You know, forget Hello, Goodbye. Forget Turn, Turn, Turn. This is the real deal. And Gene's not there. Gene wrote most of the song, and he's not there. He's gone. They're at their weakest...
What happened with Gene then? Because, I mean, he was edged out of being the kind of lead vocalist. He was edged out of playing the guitar. He'd written a lot of the songs, and so he was making more money than the others. So all sorts of tension.
Yeah, Gene had made a hell of a lot of money because all the money comes from songwriting. And he was the main songwriter in the group. He'd written maybe half a dozen songs on the first album. So there was, you know, a degree of jealousy there. But that's got nothing to do with him leaving in the end. His leaving has to do with his own neurosis, his own nervous tension. Derek Taylor wrote wonderfully about this. He, you know, most people send out a press release saying X has left the birds. He sent out this wonderfully rhapsodic piece about Gene has left the birds. He left not because of an argument, not because of this. He left because, and he goes into this wonderful prose, which goes on for paragraph after paragraph, about the punishing scene and the psychological condition he was in. It's a wonderful thing. And I spoke to Derek in, I suppose, 77, and I went back to him. I think I did the last interview before he died of cancer, and he said, I want to see you again. It's 20 years on. There is nothing more important than the birds, apart from the Fabs, of course, and decided that he would do this interview. And I asked him about the leaving of Gene Clark, and he says, you know, but the emotion you get, he's a publicist. People aren't supposed to think like this, and he put this together. And he says, you know, when I pick up that cover of Fifth Dimension, and I see the four of them on the carpet, and he's not there. He's not there on that carpet. I felt a tremendous sense of loss, the fact that he's not there. I don't like families breaking up. I don't like people leaving groups. And this is crucially important. I was devastated when he left in February 66. This wasn't supposed to happen. This was like John Lennon saying, I'm leaving the Beatles. People didn't leave groups then. I know Alan Price left the Animals, but somehow that wasn't quite as important as this. This is Gene Clark, the main songwriter, leaving the Birds. Yeah. It would be very important. If McGuinn had left the Birds, it would have been devastating. If Crosby had left the Birds. I mean, those are the big three. The other two, we could have survived, I think. But it was massive. And it was a question of, could they even survive after this? Seriously, it was that big.
Well,
we move a year on to Monterey.
This is the other great tension.
Monterey. Sid, tell us that, you know, summarise the importance of the Monterey Festival in the middle of 1967 for those acts who played it.
There's two things I want to say. First, I want to interject that Gene had the flip side of Turn, Turn, Turn and Tambourine Man, right? He had a song on the flip side. And the significance of that is when the Mechanicals and the publishing come out, he gets as much money as the guy that's on the A side. Now, he doesn't get the money for the airplay because the number one songs are played. So Gene did have, to be fair, a wildly disproportionate amount of money relative to the other guys, because when you buy Tambourine Man with I Knew I'd Want You on the Other Side, Dylan gets as much money as Gene, and Gene gets as much money as Dylan. So there was that playing into it, as the guys now admit, now that they're all friends. The interesting thing about this is, when the Sunset Strip riots happened, it coalesced and galvanized the Southern California LA community. And Dixon and Tickner and all Peter Fond and all sorts of guys that I met during my 15 years wandering around Hollywood formed this thing called the Committee for Facts and Freedom. And it was, they had benefit concerts to raise money to get guys out of jail that had been arrested by the LAPD and all this stuff. All because they wanted to shut down the kids walking on the Sunset Strip. All because they wanted to build a freeway through it, which is now San Vicente Boulevard. But out of that horrible scene, it's the movie The Riot on the Sunset Strip. I'm going really fast, aren't I? Have I lost everybody already?
No, carry on.
Out of that scene when they had the riots on the Sunset Strip and the quickie movie that came out after it, these people were now really rubbing elbows in a friendly manner. I mean, Peter, Paul, and Mary and the Byrds and all the various bands of the scene, right? They're now, and their managers are being thrown together because the LAPD are beating up their fans on the Sunset Strip. And out of that, Derek Taylor and Lou Adler and this whole crew start getting together this idea, why don't we have a pop festival? There's jazz festivals. There's the Newport Folk Festival. Why don't we have a pop festival? And this is the brilliant thing that came out of it. And I was on Radcliffe McConey not long ago talking about it. And one of the things that this did was a benefit concert. I think everybody played for free except Ravi Shankar, who had to have money because of the instruments are very incredibly fragile and all this other stuff. But I think everybody else played for free. And I was very ill during my wanderings in L.A., very ill in the early 1980s. And like all dumb young musicians, I didn't have health insurance. And you know where we're going with that, with Trump Care and Obamacare. So I didn't know what to do. And somebody told me, this is about 83 or 84. I was getting pretty ill. You can go to the L.A. Free Clinic. This is 1983 or 84. It's still funded by the money from the Monterey Pop Festival that was, of course, invested in various things. And I got treated, unbelievably enough, in the United States of America for free in 1983 or 84, all due to that festival, which I think is remarkable considering healthcare in the United States. But that was really where everybody came together. When I was in L.A. during my wanderings, one of my roommates, get ready for a name to drop, was Eric Burden. I lived with Burden on and off for 2 years. And he talked about Monterey all the time, all the time. Big, big, big fan of it. And he's the guy that told me the story I've been dining out on, that Harrison Ford, as a young jobbing actor, was a brilliant carpenter. Yeah. And Harrison Ford helped build the stages, which, of course, The Who and Hendrix tried to take apart.
And Crosby went into a great monologue about the glories of LSD and his
very much
assassination theories about Kennedy.
To this day, I can have Hillman or McGuinn interrupt and say how embarrassed they were about that. To this day. Very embarrassed about Crosby. Because, you know, when you're on stage and you speak for the band, whether you mean to or
yes.
not.
Yeah.
You speak for the guys.
Yes.
So if I come out and say...
You can't lean over a guy.
You've got to watch it. Because if I say something about Obama or Trump and healthcare in front of any ensemble I'm with, everybody better agree with me. Because when we walk off stage, it's going to be, what are you talking about?
Yeah. No, sure. Now, we're jumping ahead here because we want to cover the, you know, got a lot of ground to cover. Yeah. The great country, the great move to country, Johnny.
Yeah.
What instigates that?
What? I'm tempted to say Hillman and Graham Parsons, you know, with regard to the Byrds. It's complicated. It's a whole load of things. I mean, you know, you can argue about the excesses of psychedelia. Country was always there. There's nothing new about it. But the idea that rock stars would be playing country. The Byrds certainly weren't the first two, but there were a whole load of people that were. You know, Mike Nesmith in the Monkees, even, you know, Ricky Nelson going way back. The idea that the Byrds, after the notorious Byrd Brothers, that's less than a year, 9 months, maybe the best part of they would produce this album, was an extraordinary thing. And a lot of people had problems with that at the time, particularly over here. Notorious Byrd Brothers was incredibly successful here. You know, it got to in the top 15 in the charts, first time since Turn, Turn, Turn that they'd actually got back into the album charts. It was a big album for them. And of course, they toured over here in 68. And there's tapes available of that, but they are amazing. When they played Middle Earth, they're actually playing both stuff from the forthcoming Sweethearts. They're playing things like Hickory Wind and There's a Christian Life. But at the same time,
Middle Earth.
Yeah. But they're also playing stuff from the Notorious Byrd Brothers. They're playing, which is two completely different groups. And it actually results in, I think, some of the finest tapes ever, because it's almost like a multiple version of the Byrds. In with different factions playing two completely different styles of music and actually pulling it off quite well. It's a real a great miss that there's not a live tape of that particular period, because it's a wonderful fusion. And of course they then went into the Sweetheart direction, and it's an odd album because people call it country rock, but there's not much rock in it. It is straight country. That, you know, it was never conceived as a country.
But people moved very quickly in those days, didn't they?
And they like to label things, that just mislabeled, in my view. But it's an extraordinary record.
We'll come back to Grand Passes later, because I to borrow this. Family tree from the great Pete Frame. I just included this just to illustrate what happened to the birds. Okay. Is that, you know, you get line up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You know, what happens? You know, McGuinn stays there, and people just leave and join. Is that a fair summary?
It's more complicated than that. If that was the case, then that would be, you know, a familiar story of a band and the devolution of a band, which wouldn't be particularly interesting. You know, it happens. But what this is different. This is a sort of pullulating Olympus of L.A. rock. This the birds virtually invented, you could argue, L.A. rock. I mean, look at it. You've got the Flying Burrito Brothers, you've got country music, you've got Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
The Eagles.
These are almost, which leads ultimately to the Eagles. There's Manassas, there's the Southern Fury Hillman Band and all the rest of it. But and there's Dillard and Clark, who aren't on there, from the Gene Clark period. It's an entire movement. They've actually created an L.A. movement of rock here. I mean, even Gene Clark is probably the first singer-songwriter, if he spawns that whole tradition, which culminates with Neil Young, James Taylor, and all the rest of it. You could have another tree going down with that, even though he's not part of it. The birds were so innovative in so many areas, but what came from them? All five of them, even Michael Clark was in Firefall. You could argue that that whole 70s sort of studio anemic rock or AOR or whatever it's called. I mean, Farfel were incredibly successful. One of the great ironies of all this is that when you get to 1979, the most successful bird is Michael Clark. Crosby can't get a record contract. McGuinn's Hillman can't. You know, he's now a bluegrass player. When I say record contract, I mean a major record contract. The major labels have gone. Crosby came to me and said, Capitol turned down my album, man. They turned down my album. It was... You know, it's like Charles Dickens going, saying, "I don't want my novels anymore." He actually found it difficult to believe he could be turned down. But that's how big Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were. And the idea that Michael Clark would be left standing with Firefall, I mean, is an irony. You know,
I just want to talk a minute about the many people who were in those lineups towards the end, because I do think it's a remarkable achievement of this second volume here, which has, you know, subtitled "The Lives and Tragic Deaths." Yeah. Of Gene Clark, Michael Clark, Kevin Kelly, Gram Parsons, Clarence White, and Skip Batten.
Yeah.
That's a lot of tragic deaths, isn't it? To come out of one group.
It is, and, you know, and obviously it may not be the end, but yes, it is, and they're all odd, strange deaths.
They are, aren't they?
Can you give us a resume? Without wishing to sound too kind of morbid here, but they are extraordinary stories.
Let's get
particularly Gram Parsons.
Well, I was originally going to write it in the order of death, but it didn't work because I decided to rewrite it then in the order of their appearance in the group, because otherwise you were going back and forwards all the time. So to take them in that order, I mean...
What happened to Gene Clark?
It's a long story. No, he had a rough life. I mean, he was a heavy drinker all his life. He indulged in coke, and heroin as well. But it mainly was the drink with Gene. Gene was the drink, and you know, he had a very serious stomach operation. He's somebody who should have just given up everything after the stomach operation and concentrated on just recuperation and never going near any abusive substance whatsoever for the rest of his life. Might have saved him if he did, but he didn't. There's a lot of in the Gene Clark story, there's a lot of blame going back and forth. I mean, everybody seems to be attacking everybody else. They make him out to be very much a victim, and it's far more complicated than that. A lot of this stuff is self-inflicted, and Gene Clark created a lot of problems for himself. It wasn't everybody creating the problems for him. And there's a famous moment where Hoyt Axton, towards the end, gives him heroin, and that sets him off on this final downward spiral, I think. Not to blame Hoyt X, and it could have been anybody, but there's, you know, it's just a very sad story, because Gene was one of those people who could pull himself back from the abyss again and again. I mean, he's taking drugs and going, you know, on withdrawal things and disappearing to Hawaii and coming back clean again. He had a fantastic constitution, and he was able to do that. Crosby, who's not in that book, probably should be, but I don't know quite how he's
had a liver transplant.
Well, he did, but so loads of people have had liver transplants. Yeah. Liver transplants aren't supposed to work. He had a liver transplant, what, 94? I remember talking to a doctor, said, how long was you giving me? He said, oh, you liver transplant, you could get 10 years out of that. And here we are now.
Yeah.
And he's still going strong.
I can't let you leave the subject of Gene Clark without telling people about what happened at Gene Clark's wake.
Oh, well, yeah, that was a sad thing. Well, you know, the wake of Gene Clark, well, it wasn't a wake, it was a viewing in Hollywood for the body, and they decided to have a viewing of the body, which they normally do, and David Carradine was there, amongst others, and he pulled the body out of the coffin and start shaking it.
To remonstrate with him
about an incident allegedly involving his daughter or whatever, that caused a minor sensation at the time within there. But it was typical of, it was just the kind of thing that would happen.
Just one paragraph in this book, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
Plenty more.
Shock
plenty
horror events. Plenty more. Yeah. So, Graham Parsons, who I flipped over earlier, Graham Parsons, you know, not the most sympathetic character, is that fair to say?
Well, it depends who you speak to. A lot of people are very sympathetic towards Graham Parsons, and rightly so. A lot of people aren't. I mean, he was Graham Parsons. He was incredibly wealthy, had a trust fund. He didn't have to play if he didn't want to. And he was working musicians who had to play to make a living.
And comes across as incredibly charming. He manages to inveigle his way into Jack Nicholson's world, into Peter Fonda's world.
And, oh, yeah. Yes,
and into the birds, you know.
Yeah, and all the women loved him, you know. McGuinn's wife thought he was charm incarnate, you know. She too loved him. They all loved him. I think the birds, you know, loved him. McGuinn liked him. And you have all these stories that you assume people don't like each other, but, you know, he was always often at McGuinn's house playing pool till 3 a.m. I think he was closer to McGuinn than, apart from Hillman, than the other members of the birds, really. I mean, you know, people talk about Gene, or I don't think he knew him particularly well, but McGuinn did. And yeah, it's a complex story. I mean, all of these things, you see, you can look at it from a different angle. You have certain things that are set in stone, and until you look back and think, well, is this true or is it not true? Like Graham's relationship with his father. He hated his father. Hillman says things like, you know, he did the worst thing he could ever do, you know, he bought him a club. And I'm thinking, well, what's so bad about that? He bought him a club. He said, you're never going to learn discipline that way. And I can understand that's telling us more about Hillman, the way he thinks about the world, which is fine and true and good. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with Bob Parsons buying Graham a club to play in. It's actually quite a magnanimous thing to do. But his relationship with his father is complex. And if you look at it from a certain angle, you can see it as very negative. You look at it from another angle and think, well, if it was that bad, how come he had his father conducting his wedding? And how come he even kept the name Parsons if he hated his father that much? He could have changed. He could have gone back to Connor. He could have done loads of things. It's a complicated story. Mm. And as with all these things, it depends who you speak to and what their motives are. And as with all human life, things aren't straightforward.
Moving on to the subject of human life, actually, yeah, sure. Sid, as a kind of musician and a student of, you know, and you've written books about musicians yourself, do you find that the stories are more interesting as the people get older? That the stories told after 30, 40 years are more interesting than the, you know, the first biographies which are written, you know,
six or seven years
after the events?
In direct answer, I think what's happening is as people get older, they don't necessarily get wiser. there is a certain amount of, in my opinion, not anybody else is on this panel, but in my opinion, I see this over and over again in dealing with the principals we're talking about tonight and people that I know that aren't in the Birds but in other rock bands or whatever, or other walks of life. As you get older, it starts to become what I call legacy time. And they start to think about, if I continually bitch about Bob Hope, I'm going to go down as the guy that bitched and held the grudge against Bob Hope. So people tend to start looking at the obituary pages. I'm speaking metaphorically, of course. But all of a sudden, everybody was friends. Not all of a sudden, but as the years go on, the same comments about the same characters in the same situations in the same rock groups get mellower and, oh, he was just a big lug, and I was all overplayed our arguing and stuff. And when you know that someone perhaps slept with someone's wife, or when you know that they had a fist fight, or when something more ugly than that went down, all of a sudden everything's, oh, it was great, he was smooth. No, it was never as bad as the... And the other one is drug abuse. There's some guys that have been brutally honest after they clean up and they talk about drugs. Yeah. Lou Reed and all. And I'm not bad-mouthing Lou Reed. I'm just saying drugs are bad, blah, blah, blah. All these guys that did these amounts of drugs. Lou Reed, David Crosby, all this stuff. And yet they did all these drugs. And as they get on and they have kids or they have grandkids, and all of a sudden this huge drugs are bad, drugs are bad, drugs are bad. And I'm not saying drugs are good, but I'm saying it's legacy time, David. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. And they're looking at how they're going to be remembered.
And also... religious conversions as well has to be added to the mix, I think, particularly in America.
Yeah.
You've got the born-again movement, which had a big effect, going right back to Dylan. And, you know, that affected viewpoints. And Sid's right in the sense that some people... McGuinn's a good example. He doesn't deny anything. You know, he's, I was doing cocaine every day, and I was doing, LSD, and he talks almost nostalgically about it at times. He doesn't sort of... Whereas other people actually will try and cover up the drug abuse and really seriously downplay it to the extent that I never really was into that. I always had discipline, all right. You know, I was always in control of it. Whether they were or not is...
Well, look, you can read the story, warts and all, and there's room for loads of warts. And glory as well in these two books, which Johnny's going to do you a really good deal on in a minute.
Oh, right.
But first, we're going to finish with a parlor game, okay? You've got to choose what's the best Birds album, okay? We're going to do this in order.
All right.
Okay, there they all are with Johnny's book left and right, okay? Mark Ellen, going to start with you.
I would just to get in a plug for a couple of tracks, actually, which aren't on the album I'm going to choose, but This Wheel's on Fire, their version of that is absolutely fantastic. Just stuff I'm recommending. And also a song called Have You Seen Her Face, which is absolutely amazing, the most immaculate. If anyone's never wants an introduction to the Birds, that is glorious, glorious harmonies. But the record I think I'd probably choose, actually, is the first one, which is Mr. Tambourine Man. It's got four Dylan songs on it. It's got the Bells of Rhymney. It's got Leon Russell playing the piano. It's got, more importantly, that kind of wonderful, warm, ambient, Pacific breeze of a sound that is the signature sound that they made, which I remember so fondly when I heard it on the radio the first time when I was a kid. And I would say you cannot possibly go wrong with that first album. It's not the great songs of the Birds, because they went on to write those more songs themselves. It's mostly cover versions, but it's the great sound of the Birds. It's
well, brilliant. Nice try, Mark, but you're
okay,
wrong.
Okay, I know. No, Johnny's going to have the right answer. I know that.
The correct answer, and, we've got to be polite to Sid and Johnny by allowing them, but the correct answer is Fifth Dimension. It's as simple as that, okay? The one after Gene left, it's got the remnants of that folk rock sound, but it's edging into psychedelia. It's got Wild Mountain Time on it. It's got the title track, which I absolutely love, and it's got a great sleeve. Okay, so the answer is Fifth Dimension. Sid, when
the first thing I'd like to say is you have to get a copy of this book, Johnny's Volume 2. Because on page 339, a member of one of my contemporaries on the LA scene refers to me as a self-righteous whore, and the lowest... This is me he's referring to me as, not Johnny, thank God. And I'm also, bizarrely, thank you for putting bizarrely, Johnny, bizarrely I'm referred to as the lowest scumbag on earth. Page 339 in this book. Now, the only reason I know that is William F. Buckley used to always... get his rival Gore Vidal to send him a signed copy of a book, hoping Vidal would ask William F. Buckley to send a book back. He never did till towards the end, when Vidal, for whatever reason, said, "Bill, could you send me one of your books, please?" So Buckley, at the back, where it had in the index, Vidal, comma, Gore wrote, hi, knowing Vidal would go there first. So,
very good.
I looked up Sid Griffin first and thought, page 339, I'm the lowest scumbag on earth. Right, my favorite Birds album, and it is very, very hard to pick, but I'm going to say Notorious. I think the fact that those three guys, with Crosby's help and some session player help, could come up with an album that strong under such duress is flat out amazing.
Okay, well, Johnny.
Well, I've always found it very difficult to choose between two of them. And the two that I find difficult to choose, they're almost like one to me in a way, are Younger Than Yesterday and Notorious Bird Brothers. To me, that's the peak. But having said that, I bought all of them in order and all of them on the day they came out pretty well. I spent a lot of time studying that first album because I didn't have a record player or indeed electricity.
Excellent.
Just imagining what it sounded like.
And so I memorized things like, you know, the serial numbers and like that. And I got particularly mystified on the second album. There's no writing credit for He Was a Friend of Mine, and I used to look at that and also dream of how I could actually ever hear these songs like Oh, Susanna. But, you know, by special appointment to friends that had radiograms, I could go and have a private listen. But I got my first record player coincided with the release of So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, and 2 weeks after So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star was released, that album came out, and the fourth one. And so I don't know, it was a strange thing with Younger Than Yesterday, because I was being laughed at school by then because the Birds weren't having hits anymore, and you shouldn't, even though the Beatles and the Stones, that was okay, or the Kings, but the Birds weren't, and they were American and they weren't having hits anymore, so it wasn't particularly cool in my world to be a Birds fan. There was no concept then of anything alternative in my world, so it was quite a brave thing to love Younger Than Yesterday. And I think the defining moment for me is there was a program on the Light program called Newly Pressed, and I came home as I had in the summer of 65, and they were playing a new song from this album by the Birds, and I thought they're going to play a Birds track, and they played, of all things, they played a song called Time Between. I played it and I thought, oh, I'm not sure about this album. It had Mind Gardens on it, and it was all a bit strange. And I heard this and it was very commercial. I thought, I think the fact of hearing that on the radio, then playing it, and it all seemed to come together at once. And I played that record maybe four times a day for the next year on average. I still play it to this day. So it has to be Younger Than Yesterday.
So our four are the first one.
Yep.
Fifth Dimension, Younger Than Yesterday, and Notorious Bird Brothers. Nobody batting for Bird Maniacs, I note. There's bound to be somebody in this room going, actually, Ollie, he's probably got one good track.
I think you'll find
it's got one good track. That's all we got time for. Johnny, these two books are available to purchase this evening at the bargain price of, together...
Oh, well, the 33% off both of them, and that bottom one there, volume 115, the top one's 20, and of course anybody who buys either one of them gets a free copy of Star Maker Svengali's Thrown In as well.
Yeah. Absolutely terrific. Isn't that wonderful? And so, first of all, thanks very much for giving treating us to his insights and his bare knees and all kinds of stories. Sid Griffin. And the author of this absolutely extraordinary piece of work, who will later on tell you about how he and Mark Lewisohn nearly came to grief recently and interrupted the flow of enormous, great, authoritative rock biographies. Johnny Rogan.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.